Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Doran, and this is the 10x9 podcast. I was out on the road again last week, heading to a wonderful evening of true Christmas stories in Port Stewart, which is on the north coast overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. The gorgeous Flowerfield Art Centre was buzzing and beautifully decorated to get us all in the mood. There are 3 stories from that evening on this podcast.
Mid-November brought the first snowfall of winter 1971, leaving the surrounding valley and drumlins shrouded in a blanket of white.
In the run-up to Christmas, my father is teaching me a lesson. What do you do when your wife says, "I'd like a real tree this year"? You go and get her one. And what can be wrong with wanting to please your family?
That was the year the Germans came to dinner. The war was over. The local clergy had asked families to invite some of the men to Christmas dinner as a gesture of peace and goodwill.
A snapshot of 1970s school days, the hunt for a Christmas tree in the wild, and the day the Germans came for Christmas. But just before we get stuck in, I want to explain. The date of the event was planned months in advance, of course, but the news on December 6th was full of dire warnings of Storm Dara. Given Port Stewart overlooks the Atlantic, I was afraid there might not be much of an audience. But I should have remembered, 10x9ers are made of sterner stuff.
Good evening, Port Stewart. Thank you so much for coming out. I was listening to the radio on the way up, thinking we were heading into some sort of apocalypse. They just love to dramatise things on Radio Ulster. And then I arrive in Port Stewart and it's perfectly calm. And it's not even raining. So, I don't know, maybe later on it'll have picked up a bit. But we'll be safely home by then. So, I was reading Port Stewart. I did a quick Google search. And it was telling me that Port Stewart, according to the Sunday Times, is the best place to live in the UK. And I could well believe it. It's very beautiful. And I love coming here. And when I did Google it, it brought up, you know, recent news in Port Stewart. And one of the most shocking things that has happened, that someone smashed an ATM screen. I don't know how you live here. I don't know. You must be terrified in your beds. So if that's the worst that can happen, hey, not a bad thing.
So let's get on with the stories. And our first story comes appropriately from a first timer. Here's Fionnuala McNichol.
Facilities at the local primary school I attended lacked many amenities we take for granted today. In fact, they were non-existent for our wee County Tyrone school, built in 1912. The school staff consisted of 3 teachers, 1 for each classroom, 2 part-time dinner ladies, and a part-time caretaker. To maintain a daily smooth running within its ancient walls, senior primary 7 pupils assisted with chores. It wasn't something any of us balked at. We delighted in escaping the labour of learning for a while, especially if the master, as we refer to the one male teacher and principal, happened to be in one of his less than joyous moods. Each morning, boys rushed to carry 3 stacked crates containing 1/3 of a pint bottles of milk left by Joe the milkman behind a crumbling gate pillar, leaving one in each classroom next to pot-bellied stoves crackling with fresh kindling and reeking of flaming dusty coal. Akin to the Late Late Show then, there was one for everybody in the audience. That was until a certain iron lady decided it was too much of a good thing to provide growing children with a small bottle of calcium-rich milk and scrapped it. Without a refuse collection, approaching home time, a boy deemed trustworthy enough with a box of Bo Peep and competent not to set every oak, elm and alder ablaze, collected waste paper baskets from each classroom and burned the contents at a clearing within an adjacent woods. In the absence of a kitchen, School meals arrive pre-cooked from a central school meal kitchen in town. Once again, pupils were to the fore, carrying the varying sizes of full and empty food containers to and from the transport van. Before the dinner ladies and the meals arrived, however, a large water boiler required filling to ensure an adequate hot water supply for washing serving utensils after lunch. Filling the boiler became my morning chore, after nomination by my predecessor friend Cassie, who handed the baton, or should I say the yellow bucket, when she left for secondary school. Each morning after roll call, at the bottom of a poorly lit corridor, the yellow bucket waited in a tiny, gloomy, dank, windowless scullery, with blistering walls and blotched in black mould patches. A hairline cracked Belfast sink with a single brass faucet, dappled in verdigris, provided the school's only fresh water supply. Apart from cold water taps at the toilet block wash basins, practice taught me to fill the bucket with just enough water to prevent it splashing around me as I staggered along the peeling paint corridor to the cloakroom where the big three-legged Burko boiler sat stout on the floor in the corner. With practice, I also noted that time and motion wasn't really an issue in the job. So if I heard the master throwing a strop towards some classmates, I'd slow my pace and prolong the process. I quickly learned that a few jibbles of water on the quarry tile floor needed a little extra time too for mopping. It's amazing how learning on the job can be so beneficial. Mid-November brought the first snowfall of winter 1971. Leaving the surrounding valley and drumlins shrouded in a blanket of white. The school continued as usual. However, playtime and the big ship sails through the alley-alley-o and football were on hold. Instead, the low winter rays and biting chill had our cheeks glowing and noses drip while hurtling snowballs and building shapeless snowmen with woolen-gloved freezing hands. Amid the capering, suddenly a sharp pain shot up my leg as I went over on my ankle. In agony and unable to weight bear, my foot swelled inside ankle boots. Hurpling between two friends, I returned to the classroom, where the master, breaking from reading the Derry Journal and chewing ham sandwiches, gasped at the wonky, swollen foot and declared I'd better see a doctor. A doctor? At our school? We didn't even have band-aids. Nor indeed was there a telephone to contact a doctor, or anyone else for that matter. Meanwhile, classmate incident investigators surveying the scene concluded I had stepped off a goalpost. How could you step off a goalpost, I hear you ask? Well, just as indoor facilities were sparse, so too was the playground. During pleasant weather, boys would pull off their jumpers and roll them in a peas wisp, improvising as goalposts. However, as soon as the winter chill set in, there was no parting with their much-needed jumpers. Instead, they hunted the stony bank for sizeable stones to use. With the rocks camouflaged beneath a layer of freshly fallen snow, my ankle bore the brunt. Thankfully, though, the school had a wonderful communication method in the bush telegraph. Tess, one of the dinner ladies, lived near us, so with her work cleared for the afternoon, she hopped on her black rally bicycle and, while slithering her way home, called with my mother to relay my predicament. Mum quickly summoned my older brother, working nearby, so with all but sirens and blue lights flashing, he and Mum were soon at the school, a and I was on the road to Altnagelvin casually, where with little delay, an x-ray confirmed a foot fracture. While swaddling my leg from toe to knee in plaster of Paris, the nurse advised me not to put my foot to the ground for 6 weeks and duly provided a pair of wooden underarm crutches. Precariously hobbling to my brother's car, I felt like and probably looked like Long John Silver. As the pain and shock subsided somewhat, it dawned on me, great, this means 6 weeks off school and I'll escape sitting the 11 plus. Well, no such luck. Not with my mother in charge. The following morning and subsequent mornings, my brother drove me to school and returned to pick me up at 3 p.m. Like a scene from Driving Miss Daisy, he also escorted me to sit the 11 plus exam, where I sat answering what questions I could muster with a cast leg elevated on the seat of the desk in front. I did, though, have to relinquish boiler filling duties and passed the temporary contract to my friend Bernie, who didn't hesitate, hoping to avoid algebra and fractions. Advent arrived, and as usual, the making of paper decorations and Christmas cards. I was excused from the nativity play. Somehow a shepherd balancing a crook and a pair of crutches didn't bode well. Soon the day arrived that everyone looked forward to, as the master turned the key in the door for a full 2 weeks of Christmas holidays. As I settled into my brother's Ford Cortina, the master handed me a little brown envelope. Just a little thank you for boiler filling, he said with a broad smile, before waving us off and wishing us a Merry Christmas. An inscription on the envelope read, may your Christmas be full of happiness and free from happiness. Inside was a shining heptagonal 50 pence piece, my first wage packet. That evening, with my acquired wealth, I hobbled into Mrs. Devine's shop to buy a stash of penny mixes, Perry crisps, and a quarter of liquors all sorts, my chauffeur's favourite sweets. The holidays that Christmas 1971 continued both happy and hoppy. Following the Feast of the Epiphany, I returned to school, plaster and crutch-free. No longer incapacitated, with both feet on the ground, I soon resumed my boiler filling duties for my last couple of months at St. Mary's, which itself was on countdown to closure. However, 100 yards up the road, a brand new Maud Conn school was having its final coat of paint applied. And according to the grapevine, it even had a telephone. May you too have a Christmas full of happiness and free from happiness.
Child labour, how we miss it. Fionnuala, thank you so much. What a wonderful look into the fairly recent past. I hope we'll have more from you in the future. As I'm always reminding you, 10x9 is constantly looking for storytellers, whether new like Fionnuala or returning, so get in touch via the website 10by9.com, whether it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic. And if you're a bit nervous, shy or reluctant, I'll do my best to make it as easy a process as possible. Okay, on to our next story, and he's a regular in both The Black Box and When We Go Out and About, and he's always brilliant. He's Paul Hutchinson.
9 p.m, early December, a starless, no moon night, and I am being driven from home by my father. Driven from home into a dark wood. My father has been tasked all week by my mother. A real tree must come home. And soon. A real Christmas tree. In response to this Christmas request, my father has packed into his large mustard-yellow Volkswagen all the tools necessary for getting a tree. And by getting a tree, he means stealing a tree. But he doesn't call it stealing. Oh, no. He points out that there are lots of trees, that no one will miss one tree, that my mother wants a real Christmas tree this Christmas, that it's probably a rich farmer with plenty of trees to spare, that it's Christmas time, and that's a time for people to be generous, even rich farmers. But he laughs at that one because he knows we are planning a crime. In the run-up to Christmas, my father is teaching me a lesson. What do you do when your wife says, "I'd like a real tree this year"? You go and get her one. For her, for the family. And what can be wrong with wanting to please your family? But for some reason, he doesn't want to pay for a real Christmas tree. Money might not grow on trees, but Christmas trees do grow in a field 6 miles from where we live. So we are driving in a mustard-yellow Volkswagen estate, lights on along a bumpy dirt path, tools clanging in the back, driving from home into a dark wood. He stops and we get out. He opens the hatchback of the car, examines his stealing gear. An axe, a saw, a torch, some rope, 2 pairs of gloves. He hands me a set of gloves. I feel honored and illicit. My father and I are going to rob a forest. Together. We're going to steal a tree. It is, I must confess, very exciting. I am 15. I have been handed a pair of my father's rough work gloves, and we are now walking with purpose into a dark wood. It's hard to see anything outside the beam of the torch. I slip several times, unused to skulking at night in a field. Not too far from the car, he says. We don't want to carry it too far. I nod as if I do this every day. Steal a tree from a farmer. Steal a tree from a farmer who may or may not be rich, who may or may not be feeling generous at Christmas time, who may or may not be keeping watch over his flock of fir trees. My father shines his torch with intent. He knows what he wants. A Christmas tree for the family, a family tree, a tree of significance, a tree to place in the small living room of our small terrace house, a tree to cover with tinsel, balls, and lights. The bloody lights that need bloody tested every bloody year. As my father was prone to saying, he had no patience for fiddly lights. My mum loves Christmas, wants us all to be a perfect family and not to fight. She wants to feed us more than we need fed. I don't ask if she is ever disappointed, if it ever meets her Everest expectations. My father stops and says, "Hold the torch steady. There." He kneels down as if to pray before the tree he is about to kill, to steal, and then he starts to saw. He is physical for a living, and so he gets to it, cutting into the tree. "Keep the torch steady," he says. My hands are shaking with the cold and the nerves. These gloves are not made for warmth. They are for stealing trees and male bonding. "Sorry," I say, and hold the torch with both hands as I watch out for police, for farmers, for nocturnal animals, none of which I want to see. I want to pee, but I have a job. Hold the torch steady for my father, who is cutting down a Christmas tree 6 miles from home in a dark wood. Watch yourself, he says, as the tree starts to wobble. It's at least 10 feet high, long, big, whatever the term is for measuring a tree. He gently, firmly holds the tree and guides it to the cold ground. What do you think, he says? Put the torch on her. The tree is a she. A she tree. It's quite a bonding moment. Father and son gazing at a felled Christmas tree. He looks at me and smiles. He is proud of himself, providing for his family. He is happy at this moment, creating memories for father and son. I smile back, then look at the tree. It's wrong. It feels exciting and great and scary, but something is wrong. I kneel down and touch the tree. My anxiety is growing, not about getting caught, although that's still there, but of having to say that I think my father is wrong, that he has done the wrong thing for his family. Dad, you're wrong, I want to say. But I never ever want to say, Dad, you're wrong. It doesn't feel right. Suddenly there is movement in the bushes. We both turn swiftly. I'm imagining a farmer with a shotgun, a frown, and a growling dog. But it is an unseen creature out on the prowl, more afraid of us than aggressive. I stand up and brace myself. My dad has a huge grin on his face. I'm about to wipe that grin off his face. I say, Dad, I don't think this is right. What, says my dad, it's fine. No one will miss it. Your mum will love it. Look at the size of it. It's not fine, I say. It's not right. You shouldn't have cut this tree down. He is still smiling, but slightly less broadly. Well, we can't uncut the tree. It's down now. We may as well take it home. No, I say, feeling sick to my giblets. You shouldn't have cut this Christmas tree down because it's not a Christmas tree. My father looks at me, crouches in the starless night, takes the torch and scans the tree. Balls. He was not talking about Christmas decorations. To be fair, it was a very dark, starless, no-moon night. To be fair, we are both from Belfast and don't know our trees that well. To be fair, when you're trying to steal a tree late on 6 miles from home, your vision can be impaired. To be clear, my dad had cut down a tree that he thought was a Christmas tree, but was not in the end a Christmas tree. Balls, he said again, and then he burst out laughing. Your mum would not have been happy. It's close, but it's no Christmas tree. And so we trekked on again, looking for an actual Christmas tree, checking with each other when we found a whole field of them waiting to be cut down, waiting to be felled. We chose our tree, cut it down, and dragged it back to the car. It was too big to fit into the back of the car, so we threw it onto the roof rack, prepared earlier for such an eventuality, and we tied it down with rope. My dad laughs all the way home, thinking about the wrong tree and what the farmer would think, seeing a not Christmas tree cut down and left to die with its brothers and sisters. Maybe it would hit the news, my dad said, and he laughed. It would not hit the news. The troubles were hitting the news. We arrived home to my mother, who is not happy that we had gone to steal a tree, but who is very happy that we had brought home such a magnificent Christmas tree. In her mind, she is already in the future, seeing the tree decorated, already dressed divinely. The tinsel, the checked lights, the balls, and the smiling angel. The smiling angel on top of the tree, on top of the stolen Christmas tree, blessing her mucky-shoed Earth Holy Family.
Paul, such a good story. It's quite the gift you have. Thank you, as ever. Now, you know 10x9 is always free, but if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, 10x9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given, whether electronically or at our live events over the years. It really helps, and we are so grateful. Okay, on to our third and final story in this podcast. It was her second time at the 10x9 mic, and hopefully not her last. Here's Kate Murphy, and she started with a little introduction.
Hello, everyone. My Christmas is a bit, goes back a bit further than any of those that I've heard yet. Even Fionnuala's over here. I go back to a time when, you know, when I look around me and see even these lights here in front of me, they're so opulent, they're so extravagant in some ways, because I grew up at a time when the town lights in the little village, it's a commuter town for Belfast now, Antrim Town, it was only a village, and the town lights were turned out at 9:10 every night. Sorry, 10:10. 10:10 to allow the people 10 minutes to get home from the pictures and turned out to save electricity because the council couldn't afford to run them. So we knew Christmas lights. There was a smell of wax and hot metal. My grandfather took the red, hot soldering iron out of the fire on the range and pressed it against the stick of sealing wax, which melted and dripped onto the cord tied round the brown paper parcel. Then he stamped it with a big seal he kept in the cupboard beside the bottle of ink. This left a pattern on the soft wax that hardened almost immediately. I wanted to do it, but I was never allowed. In fact, I was only tolerated in the kitchen during this procedure if I kept a low profile and made no noise. I had made enough noise earlier. It was the week before Christmas and the chickens were being killed. They had been carefully reared and fattened, and now they were being sent to friends and relatives in post-war England, where there was rationing and food was scarce. This morning, Charlie Daly had arrived to help pull the chickens' necks and pluck them. And then they were hung up by their feet, plump breasts exposed, heads hanging down to drain the blood. I had often seen chickens hanging in rows in the butchers like that, and had even reached up to poke their eyes or pull their gizzards. But this morning I had gone into the yard in time to see Charlie corner the last frantic bird. He had trussed it expertly and set it in a line of half a dozen live chickens who were waiting their turn, as my grandfather and Charlie sat on upturned boxes and pulled necks and plucked feathers in an assembly line. I was shocked, but they laughed at me when I said they were cruel, that the chickens weren't blind, that they knew they were going to be slaughtered. They're only chickens, they told me. Maybe if they hadn't laughed, I wouldn't have felt so bad. But the more upset and angry I became, the more they laughed, until I ran crying and sobbing to my mother in the kitchen. She was too busy to offer much consolation, because she was at the end of the assembly line. She took the white corpses with their scrawny, elongated necks, boxed and packaged them, and left them ready for the ceremony with the sealing wax. but now I couldn't even enjoy that. That was the year the Germans came to dinner. The war was over, but the prisoners of war who lived in barracks near our town had not yet been repatriated. The local clergy had asked families to invite some of the men to Christmas dinner as a gesture of peace and goodwill. We always had a big family dinner in grandfather's house with all the uncles and aunts. That year, two German soldiers joined us. One was called Wolfgang, but I couldn't pronounce the other one's name. They spoke no English and smiled a lot. In an effort to bridge the communication gap, great quantities of food were pressed upon them, so they ate a lot too. There was a special present under the tree that year for after dinner. It was for all the family. But because I was the oldest child, it was in my charge, and I was very excited about it. It was a kind of cardboard tombola house with cotton wool on the roof. The roof lifted off, and inside there was a list of numbers and lots of little novelties with corresponding numbers on them. Each of the family and guests got a number, and when I took out the novelties and called their number, they got a present. There were key rings and dice and puzzles and paper hats. But I don't remember what anyone won except Wolfgang. He got a plastic fried egg. And he laughed a lot and talked to his friend in their language with the strange sounds. Then I went round and collected all the novelties, which none of the aunts or uncles wanted, and put them back into the box again so I could play with them later. My mother indicated that Wolfgang wanted to keep his egg, but I pretended not to see her and I took it anyway. After that, we played cards for pennies and halfpennies. Then the German soldiers took out photographs and showed them to us. The one with no name had a picture of his mother. Wolfgang had a picture of himself, his arm round a young woman and two children, a boy and a girl about the same age as me. They were standing in a yard full of chickens and ducks outside a house with a pointy roof. My grandfather tried to talk to him about this picture. Was he a farmer? How many chickens and ducks did he keep? Did he send them to market? Did he kill them himself? This conversation was conducted in mime. And when my grandfather made neck-pulling and plucking signs, he looked over at me. Wolfgang kept nodding, and then he pulled an imaginary chicken's neck, and he laughed. And my grandfather laughed and poured him another drink of whiskey. I hated Wolfgang. I was glad I had taken his egg.
Kate, I love that so much. What a wonderful story and another fascinating look back to a very different time. Thank you. And that is it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, 10by9.com. The dates for 2025 are all there, along with a couple of themes to get you thinking. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. I'll try to get to grips with Blue Sky too, but I can't promise anything. Thanks to everyone who made the Port Stewart 10by9 happen. The wonderful Leanne and Margaret, of course. The lovely team at Flowerfield, including Katrina and Alan, our tech support. The audience, naturally, coming out despite the storm warnings. And by the way, the storm, Dara, did arrive overnight, and it was a big one. The sea surge the next morning was quite something. I think I posted a photo on Facebook. And of course, thanks to all our amazing storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Fionnuala McNichol, Paul Hutchinson, and Kate Murphy. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.